Okay, hi, this is Mike Edison and Mr. Media. Rah, rah, let's go.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MrMedia.com. On today's show, I'll welcome Mike Edison, former editor of High Times, writer of Penthouse magazine letters that began, "I never thought it would happen to me," and a lifelong wrestling fan. He's just published his third memoir, "You Are a Complete Disappointment," which is not a love letter to his late father. This is Mike's third appearance on Mr. Media. Stick around. I could have written a book with the same title, but it would have been about what I would have said to my father, and there would have been a lot more four-letter words. In his past appearances on Mr. Media, I pretty much swooned over the arc of Mike Edison's career as a writer and editor. Editor, High Times Magazine. Foreign correspondent, Hustler Magazine. Paid letters writer, Penthouse Magazine. Contributor, The Huffington Post, Daily Beast, New York Observer, Spin, Interview, and the New York Press. Author, I have fun everywhere I go, and dirty, dirty, dirty. Screw the guy in the Dos Equis commercials. For my money, Mike Edison is the most interesting man in the world. In his third, and I suspect not last memoir, You Are a Complete Disappointment, a triumphant memoir of failed expectations, we learn how much childhood and adult grief Edison has overcome in his life at the hands of a disinterested mother and a criminally, emotionally abusive father. The title comes from the last statement the senior Edison said on his deathbed in Arizona to his son. The good news is that the man is no longer walking the earth. The bad news, as Edison writes on page 117, is that he is still only a phone call away. And I will read you a bit of that. The fact that, years later, his voice is still on the outgoing voicemail message on my stepmother's house phone does strike me as somewhat ghoulish. I can imagine it must be traumatic to erase it, but imagine how people feel hearing it. When I want to call his wife to check in, and I do, I always call her cell phone. I can't handle the old man telling me to leave a message, or do anything for that matter, from beyond the grave. Mike Edison, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thanks. Thanks, Bob. I'm glad to be here. I don't know. Wow. I mean, I know I can be a little bit abrasive, caustic towards my old man, but I don't know if I'd go as far as to say I'm glad he's not here.
No, I said it. You did. You never said it.
I know. I don't know whether I would have said that or not. But you know, when my dad died, I mean, he was pretty abusive and he was a bully to me. But when he died, I cried a lot. Of course, I did. You know, like any son would when their dad died. And you know, in my case, I had an odd sort of closure. You know, because he told me his last words were, "You are a complete disappointment." And he was just getting started. I mean, that was just the beginning of this, you know, this salvo. You know, it was terrible. It was in this hospital room in Arizona, and he was plugged in with all these tubes shooting out of his arms and things buzzing and beeping and nurses running around. And, you know, he says, "Come on over. Something I want to tell you. You've been a complete disappointment." Like, you know, at that point, what are you going to do? You got to take it on the chin, right? Not to set the bar too low of what it means to be a mensch, but I'm not going to fight back against a guy dying in a hospital bed. But that was really, really just the beginning. But when they wheeled him off, I mean, yeah, I cried. But at least I knew I wasn't going to hear him say, "Son, I'm proud of you." I mean, that ship had sailed. I'd kind of waited a long time to hear that. And I mean, that's closure. I mean, it's not exactly what I would have hoped for or what I wish on anybody else, but you know, there you have it. Well, he kind of gave me this great gift by because now I have the story I can tell.
Well, I was going to say, if past is prologue, clearly you were not going to get. You know what? I've been wrong my whole life, and I want to take it all back. The thing about, and we learn that as the book goes on. Clearly, I mean, can you point to a moment or two moments with your dad where he was the dad that you know most kids want to have or have experienced?
You know, I can't, and that's kind of fucked up because I really, really looked, you know, to a moment of playing catch. We didn't do that. In fact, when I wanted to play Little League baseball when I was a kid, my dad said, "No, you're not good at it." I mean, I don't think he wanted to drive me to the practices. And also, for him, who was kind of a snob, like I said in the book. Anything that involves a T-shirt with the name of a pizzeria on the back, you know, is probably beneath his station. No, not really. You know, I started playing, you know, music. You know, I've been a moderately, you know, successful musician and, you know, toured the world and stuff, playing in my bands. When I started out playing the drums when I was just a kid, no, you know, you're no good. You can't do it. When I was in the school band, they told me it was horrible. I don't really remember. I wish I could, you know, say, oh, it was great when we used to, like, you know, play catch in the backyard. He used to encourage me. I mean, I think there was a moment when he did encourage me, I guess, when I was about third grade, but it ended, like, really quickly. Like, my mom said, I was 8 or 9 when he gave up on me entirely, when he realized I wasn't going to be, you know, this preppy picture of perfection, that I was getting to get some of my own ideas. and that's kind of when he gave up on me. And I have 2 younger brothers, and I think he, you know, thought he'd have a better chance with them. As it is, they turned out to be a stockbroker or an investment banker. He'd kill me if I said stockbroker, an investment banker, and a lawyer. So I guess maybe he was right.
It's amazing in the book to realize that at 9 years old, your father gave up on you. But it clearly it is. And, I think what part of what killed me in reading the book is, and you just mentioned, you know, did he ever go out and play ball with me or anything? You know, when my dad came out of the house to play ball, he played ball with 2 kids from down the street. Never played ball with me. I felt your pain in this book so much. I hated my dad. You know what you said, that you know when he said that to you at his deathbed. When my dad died, I shocked my brother and sister and other people who came. It was a very small funeral. He did not leave a lot of friends. I said exactly what I thought. I had to get it out of my system. I'm impressed that you didn't. You're a better man than I.
No, I don't know. I don't know that to be true. But if my book can help you in any way, Bob, I mean, I'd be really, you know, humbled by that. But the thing that I had to learn was that my dad was actually a tragic character, and something, you know, something, somebody had done something to him that fucked him up to make him this way. His parents were cold. They were stiff. They didn't know how to play with their kids. They were snobs. You know, they were very highbrow and punched, you know, at people below them. And that's sort of where he came from, this like loveless sort of house. I don't know that he wanted to have kids. He once said, oh, I'd be happy, just as happy without them, which he quickly dialed back and said, no, I'm happy with the way things are. But for a narcissist, I think he would have been very happy just, you know, living this life. And, you know, unfortunately, I think he married the wrong girl. I mean, my mom, when they got married, you know, she's a great looking Jewish girl, and came from a much different background than he did. I mean, she was definitely, you know, a catch in that, A, she was, you know, this terrific looking woman who played tennis, which he loved, and she sort of had some of these preppy things, but she also came from economically, I mean, their relative poverty. And this kept him in control, you know, and he was able to sort of mold their lives, but as it turned out, their value systems weren't the same. She wasn't buying into it all, nor his remoteness and his coldness, I don't think, and his abject selfishness. That ended pretty bad. But they had 3 beautiful kids. On the other hand, unfortunately, I don't think he ever really saw the blessing that is.
I thought it was interesting as the book began. I was expecting to find out that he was a loser, that he never amounted to anything. But the fact is, you describe he was a very successful man, and that was not what I expected.
And if you had met him, you would have liked him, because he would have been very – well, you know, I'm telling you, he was very charming, and he could be. And that's – you know, it's what I call, you know, the kayfabe, you know, my favorite word, which is a professional wrestling term, kayfabe, which means that – it means maintaining the illusion that everything you see is real. And it means playing the character and never breaking the character. So the Iranian sheik is going to be an Iranian sheik when he goes home, you know, with his kids. He's never going to be mowing the lawn unless he's got the keffiyeh on. You know, the drill sergeant and, you know, the Russian communist and you know, back in the old days, the Indian chief or whatever gimmick you're working, that's who people were. And good guys and bad guys were really good guys and bad guys. They didn't drink together at the hotel bar. That's kayfabe. It's an illusion. And that my father's kayfabe, his gimmick, was this genteel, preppy perfection. You know, which he always maintained. And it's a little scary. You know, he worried a lot about what other people thought all the time, worried too much about it. And both my parents, they were worriers. Jewish mom, I mean, I know she cared about me. She loved me, and it comes out as worry. But it was tough living under this long shadow of fear, really. You know, the epigram in my book is from Bill Hicks. It says, if you're living for tomorrow, you'll always be a day behind. And, man, my parents just fretted over everything, calories, carbohydrates, you know. I mean, they never wanted to be free or loose or frivolous. Oh, my God, frivolity, the great crime of being silly, lest someone think that they you weren't serious. Or, you know, my dad was really a social climber, an upward social climber. And like I said, though, that was his gimmick, and you would have liked him because to you he would have been very charming. To me, not so much.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, my wife's father was kind of like that to the outside world. Everybody loved him. I loved him. He was always great to me. But it was an abusive household for many years, and he was hard as hell on his kids. Not in a way that wanting to make them better people. It was just the way he treated them. And they never understood why, you know, like I come along and it's like, wow, he's a lot of fun. He's an interesting guy. He's a good storyteller. He took me to the officers club at the base. You know, they're like, that's not him. That's not the guy, which I'm guessing is similar to your experience.
Exactly. And this is my story. This is not my brother's story, who had a different experience with my dad and his wife, his second wife, I mean, who loved him, and they were very much a team together. My mom, before she died, opened up, and she saw what was going on, and she was very hurt and upset by it. But he, you know, the rest of it, you know, it was the kayfabe. The rest of the world, they saw, you know, the drill sergeant and the Indian chief and what he wanted them to see.
When did you kind of realize, growing up, that your dad may have been different from other dads?
Well, my house was was pretty bad growing up. People were yelling constantly before my parents were divorced. It was a lot of yelling. It's a really negative environment, and I found myself eating dinner at my friends' houses quite often. You know, even when I was like 8 and 9, I'd sleep over. We'd have dinner, I think they knew that it was bad, you know, a little bit bad at my house, just because, you know, there was so much bitterness and my parents were fighting all the time. Although I don't think anybody – I asked when I was writing the book, some of my old friends would be back, do you really have any idea? And they're like, no. You know, they kind of had a little bit of an idea that no one was around. I mean, my parents were very remote, both emotionally and physically. I mean, I was a real latchkey kid. I mean, there was no one around for dinner. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent my adolescence begging for supervision, basically. But to go over someone's house and see their parents and kids – and they're having dinner and they're talking about, you know, stuff like, what did you learn in history class, you know, today? Do you have a girlfriend? Oh, you like the Beatles? I like the Beatles.
Right.
You know, I mean, any goddamn thing. And like a normal family that had conversations that they were present in each other's lives. And that my friends felt that they can go to their parents to ask them questions, you know, about anything, about algebra homework or about life or, you know, anything at all, where I couldn't even imagine asking my parents for advice. My father, gave me the wrong advice every time. I started to realize this. I don't know whether he was trying to teach me a lesson or build character, but I realized, I realized later that he was just fucking terrified because I was showing, I had these ideas, these great big ideas. I wanted to be an artist and a writer and a musician, and I wanted to like start coloring outside the lines. And to a guy like him, it was a threat because it really questioned his system, you know? If I were to be a success by breaking rules, then it meant that his system was flawed. I mean, it was a real indictment of everything that he had believed, that you go to a school and you fight, you get good grades, and the grades are the only thing that matters, and you get a good job, and you get married. Of course, I mean, he was miserable, so how good a system was it really?
Right.
But the idea that I could be successful by, you know, banging on a drum set or by taking pictures or by scribbling in a notebook, it was horribly terrifying.
How much of your life and your career do you think was a direct and opposite reaction to everything that you grew up with him? I mean, your book is I want to get the title right because we might as well plug it again. But, come on. Everything I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. No, well, not that one, but the last book, I Have Fun Everywhere I Go.
Which I'm not prepared.
No, it's all right. But, I mean, that's Mike Edison, as I've come to know him. That's the guy.
Well, thanks. Well, that's a fully formed me, sort of. I mean, you know, I'm still finding myself through my 20s and 30s, certainly. But I think I'm the same guy I was when I was 8, and that's, you know, in many intents and purposes, I definitely was. I loved rock and roll from the second I heard a Chuck Berry record on the American Graffiti soundtrack. It was a kind of a big deal in 1975, I guess, when it came out. I was a little kid and I heard that. I knew what I wanted to do. That was like a bolt of lightning. And I decided I want to be a writer. I found I was okay with words. You know, I could string a few together and, you know, sound human plus, maybe, for the day, and throw paint around. And this is the direction I wanted to go. Boy, man, they were scared. I think I'm the same guy I was when I was 8. You know, I have very vivid memories of like building blocks and gluing things together, but like making a mess and like people kind of be like, you know, separating crowds.
But your dad was against fun. Your dad, you never saw your dad having fun. I mean, you gave a great story. You talk about going to the White Birch Inn, which for me would have been the Brunswick Grove in East Brunswick, New Jersey, because I should mention we grew up in the same part of the world, essentially. And you go there with the family, the Goldstein family, I think, from down the street. Mm-hmm. And this is like the worst thing that could ever happen to your dad, because everybody's trying to enjoy themselves. And something as simple as they want you to try a piece of meatball pizza.
Meatball pizza incident.
Ruined everybody's night.
It was the worst fight I ever saw my parents get into in public. And it was horrifying. It was mortifying. People at the bar were like staring. And, you know, it wasn't really their kind of place because, you know, it was like this cocktail lounge up on Route 1 and 9, which is, you know, this horrible stretch of, you know, road, like, you know, running towards the Rahway prison. You know, there was like some hot sheet motel across the street, but they had great pizza there. They had really great pizza there. And, you know, this was not a place Jews went to. You know, this was a decidedly goyish place, not for my parents. They were strangers in a strange land because they would never go to a cocktail lounge. Oh, my God. But there they were, the Goldsteins, our neighbors, who somehow discovered this pizza. I'm assuming they had some Gentile friends who were progressive enough to invite the Jews to this place. But, I mean, the pizza was great, but it was my father. They were never going to – this was a family dinner situation. We're going to have some pizza. We're going to share. We're going to get some pitchers of root beer. My parents were never good at the family dinner thing. They don't understand sharing. And, you know, the only other restaurant I'd ever been to in my life – this happened, I should mention, when I was like 8 years old. The only other restaurant I'd ever been to was the Jade Pagoda, also sort of up there on Route 1 near Woodbridge, I guess. And, you know, they'd order the poo-poo platter for two, even though there were five of us. and never share entrees. They'd order the lobster Cantonese, which I think was like a cheap source of lobster, which, you know, is a very Jewy thing to do in a Chinese restaurant. Not for children. Adults only, but they weren't good at sharing. They weren't good at enjoying. They weren't, you know, that wasn't their thing. And my father started this huge fight because I wanted the meatball pizza. The Goldsteins had the meatball pizza. And no, we're not getting meatballs. And why not? Try the meatballs. And it just turned to this horrible row. And I realized, you know, just how awful and sad and tragic there was, because you couldn't even see this great blessing. You're sitting there with, you know, with your three kids having pizza with root beer. I mean, the best pizza imaginable, right? I mean, up until then, I mean, to me, pizza was just this greasy thing. I never really thought that pizza could be good, right? I mean, pizza was pizza. You didn't even drive out of your way to get pizza. You went to the closest, cheapest place. End of story. The White Birch Inn was like this palace, you know, where, you know, of this elevated pizza with thin crust that wasn't like, you know, all gooey. And it was like really something else. And we're sitting there and Elton John's on the jukebox. And it could not possibly have been better. I mean, this was heaven, not just for an 8-year-old, but for anybody, you know, right now. I mean, I realize, you know, these simple pleasures rule. You cannot, no matter how successful you are, you cannot, no matter how much money you make, you cannot improve on meatball pizza and root beer and Elton John on the jukebox. And my father never got that. And he didn't know how to live in the moment. For some reason, there was always, he had to worry about it. And what was coming around the next corner, I don't get it. I don't get it. Because, I mean, right now, I mean, when this is over, now I'm thinking about it. I think I'm going to go get some meatball pizza and drink some root beer and listen to Elton John, because what could possibly be better?
And I'm sitting here going, geez, I wish I could go to the Brunswick Grove.
Well, I'm sure where you live, there's a place that says New York-style pizza, right, down in Florida.
Yeah, but it's you know, ghastly.
Yeah, of course. Let me tell you something. The more places New York style on it, the more you can be sure it's not.
No, of course not. No,
there was a place near where my mom lived down in Florida that was called, you know, the Oasis or something, which is, you know, like this gated community with a, you know, golf course, which, you know, no matter how much you call something something, it's never going to be that thing. And this was just, it was not an oasis, trust me. This was just something, you know, kind of a gated community where some Jews could block off the meth labs and the Denny's and the bail bondsmen and the pawn shops and what used to be abortion clinics, I guess, before they got boarded up, sadly. But yeah, there was a place near our house, and it was called New York Style Italian Restaurant. That was the actual name of the restaurant.
Right, right.
It was called Gino's New York Style Italian Restaurant. It was just New York Style Italian Restaurant. And she's like, oh, yeah, yeah, it's great. And they'd give you, like, you know, a bucket of veal parmesan. I mean, it was just, like the worst thing, you know, imaginable. But that was my mom, you know, she didn't really understand the whole food thing. Or, you know, it was more than – it's more than fuel.
Did you ever, as an adult, ever run across the Goldsteins again? Did you ever get to ask them about that?
Oh, no. You know, I have no idea. I did, you know, writing the book, I did, you know, try to contact some people. Most of the principals, you know, I mean, part reality check, you know, part actual, honestly, you know, courtesy to make sure that I'm not bending anybody's reality too far. I don't know them, but I did talk to a few other people. What was shocking is one kid I grew up with said to me, oh, your dad was wonderful. He really helped me out. I was like, what? Like, you know, it's like a Tex Avery character. He's like, it does not compute. He's like, he what? And he goes, oh, yeah. He like gave me a recommendation from college. And, you know, I was like, what the fuck? You know, I had no clue. I had no clue at all because that was not my experience.
Did you ever know anybody in junior high or high school? Because you talk a little about those experiences. Who you found out that their old man was, or even their mother for that matter, was in the same league as yours? I mean, that's
not at the time. But I'll tell you now, in talking to you, that the more people I speak with about this book, and as I was writing it and telling them what I was doing and telling them this horrible thing my dad had said to me, you are a complete disappointment, and the way he sort of bullied me, you know, you'll never make it, you're not as smart as you think you are. I heard so many people telling me, oh, my God, I had a very similar experience with my father. Women telling me they had a similar experience with their moms, just being constantly put down. And especially people who were in the arts, people who wanted to do anything besides be insurance salesmen. And, you know, people, anybody who wanted to step, you know, out of you know, the middle lane. You know, I have wonderful friends. They wanted to be – they're celebrity chefs now. I mean, they're like really successful, you know, restaurateurs and chefs in New York. And their dad would be like, what, are you kidding? You want to work in a kitchen? What, are you a fag? You know, I mean, like really awful. And they're superstars now. And you know, God bless them. That's what this book is about. It's about being the person you want to be, not the person you were told you should be. Yeah. And if there's one message that I do want to share without, you know, being too preachy about it, I mean, that's the important thing, is to follow your own star. And I don't describe myself as a rebel. I mean, I think you sort of asked me that before. Did I think about my whole life was this, as far as like fleeing, you know, from Egypt? No, I don't self-describe as a rebel per se. Of course I went in the other direction. My parents were fucking miserable.
Right.
So, of course. But rebel in the sense of like Marlon Brando, what do you got, you know, kind of rebellion, or James Dean kind of rebellion? No, I just was trying to be happy.
Yeah, I think that's the way I've always encouraged my kid to be that way. Make the decisions that are going to make you happy day to day. Don't. I think my father was miserable his whole life, and I would never want to be that person. But yeah, I mean, let me ask you this. So, did you? I wasn't really sure from the book. Have you ever married?
No, I've never been married.
So no kids, I'm guessing.
No kids. No kids. Not married. I mean, I came close a couple times, and I for no other reason except the timing wasn't quite right. Could happen. You know, it could definitely happen. I think I would have had kids if I had met the right girl at the right time, and it would have been a logical extension of our love for each other and what we wanted to do in this world, but it didn't happen. I'm really happy the way things are, to be honest with you. So I also know that, like, talking about kids, someone surely is going to say, well, look, Edison, you don't have kids. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Oh, no, I was thinking the opposite. It's just that you – I wondered if you made a conscious decision based on your own experience that you didn't want to go that path.
No, I like kids, and people say, oh, you'd be a great dad, because I do believe unconditional love is the answer, and I choose compassion over cruelty every fucking time. Mm-hmm. Count on it. I've been bullied, and I would never go down that road, and I'd want to encourage my kids. I mean, that's what I wrote in my book. I mean, you know, no matter who they are, no matter what they want to be, you know, if your son wants to be a baseball star, you go out and you play catch with him, you know? And if your daughter wants to be a baseball star, you go out and you play catch with her, you know? Your boy wants to be a ballet dancer, you take him to the ballet. You tell him, you know, Nuri, I've got more pussy than Frank Sinatra. Whatever it is, you encourage your kids. I'm not saying to be unrealistic, right. but of course you encourage your kids to follow the star.
Well, the thing some people miss is, and you seem to have grasped it, in my idea, is that if your kids can't come home and have at least one person supporting who they want to be and what they want to do, whether it's realistic or not, that's no life for a kid. And I mean, that, I marvel at your book.
And that's what we're talking about, kids, yeah. For Christ's sakes. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say to, you know, a 35-year-old guy who's been sitting on the couch smoking dope thinking he's going to be a rock star. It's like, well, maybe that boat has sailed.
Right.
But
right.
To an 8-year-old, no, you can't do it. I mean, I don't believe in telling an 8-year-old they can't do anything, you know, within reason. No, you cannot set the house on fire to see what happens, I guess. But, yeah. I mean, lying to kids is just awful, too. I mean, my God. Yeah, I mean, I was just told the worst scare stories about drugs and this. I mean, that was the time, of course, but everything was a cautionary tale. There was no ever any light at the end of the tunnel. There was no happy endings.
You may be one of the...
No one makes it.
Mike, I think you may be one of those guys who will make a great dad a little later in life than you might have made 15 years ago. Just my opinion.
You know, I'm always open to the possibilities, and that's sort of what this book is about as well. It's being open to the world.
How important is it that you got this behind you? You got this story out. It's off your chest. I was going to ask you, actually, do you feel like, and I don't know your dad's size, but do you feel like you've got 175 pounds off your back that you've been carrying around for 48, 50 years?
Yeah, in some ways, certainly, and as you can imagine, it's cathartic writing a book like this. And I feel like by the time I got to the book, though, I was sort of past it. I mean, the important thing, what I'd love to share with you, know, you, Bob, you know, if you're harboring bad feelings about your old man, is, you know, I think it's time to find some forgiveness and some compassion. Not always that easy, but remember that it's not for him. You're not forgiving him for him. You're forgiving him for you, because it frees you and it disconnects you from the anger and it disconnects you from his shitty fucking attitude. And that's what I had to learn. And it's not easy to forgive my dad for a lifetime of being a bully and being a dick. But when I was able to and find some compassion and realize that, you know, he was a troubled guy. I mean, my God, if you're on your deathbed and the last words, you know, to your kid are "fuck you, you suck." I mean, you've got some unresolved issues.
Yes, that's true.
But I had to find it in my heart to forgive him. That's really, really important. It took a while. I took a little time on a shrink's couch. I did have to, you know, write a book. But honestly, right, by the time I was writing the book, I'd been through so much, I felt like now I'm just telling the story.
Just for the record, I said my piece to my father while he was alive. And then I let it go. I bring it up now because in reading your book, I was thinking about it. But I don't dwell on him whatsoever, day in, day out.
I just hear so many horror stories since I started talking to people about writing this book about you'll never make it, they don't want you, you'll never get a job, this isn't how to do it, you dress funny, you're stupid, you're fat, you, this, that, or the other thing. It's just really horrible to tell a kid that.
Oh, the stuff that you repeat from your dad was just like, I mean, you could have told this, you could have done this as a novel, you know, and people would have found it more believable. But I believe it. I mean, it just
trust me. It's this is how it fucking happened. It is the way it went down. And all my books, no kayfabe, is what, no. You know. it's a shoot. It's real. In my first book, I have fun everywhere I go. I mean, I laughed. I told people I had to leave some stuff out because I don't think they would have believed it. It's all true. I promise you. No fabulization, no fiction, nothing like that.
I love your stories, and I love the way you tell them, so you don't have to convince me. Trust me.
Thank you very much.
One of the things I was thinking, though, we were talking before about the high school, that era, junior high. It seemed like even the asshole who beat you up and stole your jacket in high school had a better relationship with his dad than you did with yours. I mean, it sounded like they lifted weights together, they took steroids together, maybe they even sold dope together for all we know, you know?
Yeah, they might went to jail together, too.
Well, there you go. maybe that's where they're reading your book.
You know, this actually isn't in the book, but I did try to look him up later, not to make peace or talk to him or any like weird thing like that, because, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, I think that horse is, you know, left the stall. But I want to see where he ended up, and he got a pretty big rap sheet of, like, you know, domestic violence and assault and DWIs. I mean, he can't have had a happy life either, so I find him a compassionate figure. I mean, that was the worst day of my fucking life, getting beaten up, and the kid, you know, took my cool army jacket and right. that I'd saved up and bought and, you know, like, beat me up right in front of the school. Oh, man, it was awful. You know, I couldn't tell my parents. They didn't give a fuck anyway. They weren't even around. Right. It was, like, hugely... deeply humiliating. I mean, and you know, you feel shame, you know, and as a victim of this. But as far as it goes now, I feel like, I mean, his father was like giving his kid beer and cigarettes when he was 8 and 9 and teaching him that he could punch his way out of any problem he had in life. So, you know, finding compassion is pretty, pretty important to this whole story. I think that keeps me much more of a level person now.
It's funny, after reading the part about this guy tormenting you and the guy who stole your jacket, I put the book down for a minute and I went online and I looked up the name of this guy who tormented me in junior high school, because mm-hmm. I thought, I have to be honest, my first thought was, maybe he's dead. That would be nice. I could live with that. Or maybe he's in jail. I could live with that too. Mm-hmm. This happened up in New Jersey. Do you know what I found? The guy is 2 hours south of me in Florida. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God. Oh my God! And it I couldn't find his jail record, but the information about him showed up through a Florida court search. So I don't know exactly. I didn't dig deep enough, but that I got some satisfaction that that's the only record of the guy.
Well, you know, kittens become cats, children become men and women. yeah, it's weird, but this guy he's still living. You know, not the best of circumstances from what I could suss out. And like I said, you know, I mean, it sounds like a Larry David episode. I'd probably bump into him to party and still try to push me around or something. But, you know, I just find it's better to feel compassion for these people. You know, they know not what they do. And I have to figure that out about my dad. I mean, you know.
Well, you have one of those odd job hats now. So if the guy starts giving you a hard time, you just... swing the hat at him, right?
Flush with love shoe too, so I can stab him.
Now, you've got the twin brothers, right?
My brothers are twins.
Right. So, have they read the manuscript?
They've read a little bit about it. I guess my next book could be called "I Wrote a Memoir." Now my family wants to kill me.
is that where?
It's not so bad. Well, the first book, I ruffled some feathers. Definitely, it's a bit of scorched earth policy. Boy, my mom was not happy with that first book. She didn't read it. My mom is so detached from what I actually do. You know, even she only died a couple of years ago, and I had written a bunch of books, and you know, and so, a couple of them, you know, fortunately, fairly successful. And she would ask me, "So, can people buy your books in the store?" I mean, she had no idea because she didn't know anybody that created content.
Right.
You know, anybody that worked television or movies or books or publishing or art. It was just sort of this thing that other people did and it doesn't exist. I live in New York City. I mean, I'm surrounded by this, which she couldn't quite come to terms with. That's what I did. I mean, she was still telling me, "Oh, you should go back to school. You should become a school teacher." I'm like, "Mom, I'm actually doing okay."
Yeah, right.
I work all the time.
Yeah.
My brother would say, "Listen, you know, I mean, you know, Michael's, you know, I mean, it's up and down. I'm a writer. I mean, you know, I mean, it's definitely up and down." But he's like, "Look, the guy figured out how to do the things that make him happy. I mean, he's out there playing his guitar and singing songs or banging on a piano or writing books, and he's really happy. And, you know, he's got this great, great place in New York City, and it's happening. So what's the fucking problem?"
Right.
Because, oh, you know, the old joke, right? It's first woman president. Right, first Jewish woman president, and she's up there on the steps of the Capitol building, and her mom's in the audience. And says to the person next to her, "You see that woman up there? That one with her hand on the Bible? Her brother's a doctor."
Yeah, right. That's great. I know that's in the book. That was great.
Good enough for you. You know, meatball pizza, Elton John, root beer. What the fuck is wrong with you? How much more do you want?
I don't know. I there was one more thing, speaking of parents, that you wrote about, and that was the books that your parents had next to their sides of the bed. My dad had a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies.
Oh, well, that was my dad's.
Never cracked the spine. It just moved from point to point around the house. My mother had the same books, the Jackie Collins and the Harold Robbins. And the fun thing for me – and I love my mom. I've always had a great relationship with her. The funny thing for me was over the last couple of years doing this show, Jackie Collins has been on three times.
Oh, wow.
And I had to tell her that I got to know her books by sneaking them from my mother's side of the bed and reading them. And, you know,
think that's the first time that Jackie Collins has heard that?
Oh, of course not. Of course not. And, you know, I mean, that's, you know, that and the Harold Robbins and the Carpetbaggers and all that stuff. I mean, that's some of the first tastes of sex that we got.
That stuff was, like, so fucking steamy.
Yeah.
Like, crazy fucking hot. You know, I tell the story, you know, I think people should go out and buy the book. I don't want to give it away. This is adults only. You got to pay at the door for this story. But holy fucking cow, my mom was reading like these books, and the scenes I was reading were like cocaine and call girls and, you know, and kink of every imaginable variety. And, dude, I went on to become a pornographer. I wrote Penthouse Letters. This is the filthiest fucking thing I've ever read in my life. You know, and I found it like on the kitchen table.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
From the public library. Wow. So, I mean, the mind.
Yeah, I wanted to do what you did. I've got all the rejection letters from all the places that you worked. This was before you were there, because I think I'm a couple of years older than you. But yeah, and it's just – I don't know. So the book is out. The book is done. What is Dr. – yep, yep. What is – we'll be showing it plenty of times. What does Dr. Headshrinker say now that the book is done? Are you cured? Can you move on without the good doctor?
Cured? Are we ever cured? She was great. Just to put it in some context for those coming in naked here, Dr. Headshrinker is what I lovingly call my therapist, the woman who I went to see. My a colleague of mine said, I was obviously after my dad, you know, told me on his deathbed, you know, hey, you're a loser, you're fat, you're not that smart. Complete disappointment. I couldn't get his voice out of my head. And honestly, you know, it fucked me up a little bit, as you can imagine. Also, there were a few other things going on. I had broken up with a long-term girlfriend. My cat died, and I lost my job. Like all at once, right? It was like the summer of suck, I called it. I was just really getting pummeled and feeling a little overwhelmed. And for a month, I said, well, you know, you should go talk to my shrink. You know, she'll help you out. So, I'm probably the last Jewish guy in New York City not to have a shrink. Why not? I'd never actually been to a therapist before, and I lovingly call her Dr. Headshrinker with her opinion. She thinks that's cute. And, you know, she's great. I would recommend the experience to anybody. I didn't know what to expect when I got there, what I know about shrinks. I know, like, watching Alfred Hitchcock Spellbound. I know watching Frasier, you know, on TV. Lucy Van Pelt, you know, the doctor is in, 5 cents. I really didn't know. I mean, all I know is what I saw on, you know, TV and what this is supposed to go like. But it's great to be able to talk to someone who doesn't know you, a professional who could offer some opinions. And she was very encouraging and said, you know, first of all, like, oh man, you know, I feel like, you know, poor little Jewish boy singing the blues because daddy didn't love him enough. And am I really just whining? And she got a sword to me and she says, no, you know, it's abuse. You know, what you went through is genuine and it is abusive. And it's not easy. And she said, you know, so many people come into my office with these stories and they don't always, the stories don't end up as well as yours does because you seem pretty happy. And by and large, I was at the time. I mean, I was getting dinged up by life a little bit that summer and, you know, with my dad, that whole deathbed soliloquy, you know, was kind of fucked up. But, she reminded me that I had become the person I want to be. And really, you know, I just sort of needed, you know, a little, you know, reinforce my own belief in myself. She was great, and she would say to me, "I don't know why you're still coming here. It's not my job to tell you to stop." She was sort of teasing me because, you know what, it's healthy because we started out talking about my dad, and we ended up talking about, you know, something else. But she definitely helped me find just some clarity, talking it out, just having someone to know, to download some information on and get an opinion from someone who doesn't know you. It's fantastic. I really came out of the whole therapist experience. It was very positive. It wasn't so heavy. You know, it wasn't like, you know, lying on a couch and, you know, no one was zapping my brain with electrodes or anything. It was all very, for this casual Greenwich Village Jewy therapist, you know, situation. Not like what I imagine Woody Allen's life to be like at all.
So what's next? What are you going to do next?
I want to write another book. Well, first, we're going on tour. First, because this is my favorite part. I love we get to go on a tour, and it will be a you are a complete disappointment. We call it the completely awesome book tour. I just sort of crossed out disappointing and wrote in awesome with a crayon, because that's pretty much where I'm at with this. But I'm excited. So we're going to be in Metuchen, New Jersey, woohoo! But also New York City a bunch of times, including the Barnes Noble on the Upper West Side and Book Court in Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, which is where I live. We're going to California. I'll be in San Francisco and L.A. and Oakland. We're going to Chicago and Milwaukee. I mean, it's a real tour because, you know, I'm a rock and roll guy, and I have this sort of punk rock DIY mentality, and I feel like a troubadour, and it's what we do. You get on the road, and you tell your stories, and you go from town to town, and you tell your story. That's what I always wanted to do as a musician, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to write books and, you know, in a way that I can get the word out, and I appreciate your enthusiasm and support. So when I show up, I'm bringing my piano player on the whole tour, world's greatest piano player, Mickey Finn. And you know, look, I'll be honest with you, Bob. I think most book readings suck. This is how I got into this whole thing with bringing musicians with me, because I just been to readings and by people I admired too, and they'd be at some podium reading a book, and it kind of took a lot of the mystique of being of the whole thing out for me. The book was great. The storytelling in person wasn't so good. So I got a bongo player. You know, I don't even really like Jack Kerouac's books that much, but I love the records he made, and I love him reading with Steve Allen on piano. And that's where I got this concept. So I had a bongo player, and I read, and someone said, "Oh, that's really good." And I'm used to being on stage, so I have that. You know, I'm used to be playing in front of people. And then I had a stand-up bass player. The next thing I knew, I kind of had a jazz band behind me. And telling these stories, it just took on this whole new life. Now I'm working with my piano player because it sort of seems to be the best of both worlds and can't really take the band on the road. And we rehearse the fuck out of it. I mean, we really rehearse. People are always surprised to hear how much rehearsal goes into showing up at a bookstore. And I have a theremin I play, and we really come, you know, loaded for bear. I want people to come out and say, like, holy shit, that is as fine a reading as I've ever seen, as fine a book, you know, book performance as it is. I just, you know, I mean, I think that obviously the author and the book are intertwined, but I'm a guy. You know, I walk and talk, and being in person is a much different experience than reading my book. It's important to me to come out and, you know, bring it very powerfully to the people.
Mike Edison, you are as much a guy as any guy I've ever met. Let there be no doubt, folks. And folks, listen, you can find...
I like to think I'm in touch with my feminine side as well.
Oh, I'm sure you are, but I'm not paying
attention. I take a lovely Dijon vinaigrette.
I'm not paying attention to that side. Folks, you can find Mike Edison's books, including the latest, You Are a Complete Disappointment, a triumphant memoir of failed expectations, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it. There it is, and any of his other books right now at a great price, MrMedia.com. If you are watching on the MrMedia.com site, just below the video, you can look down and you'll see the cover of the book. There you go. It might be on the other side. It might be there. It might be – yeah. There you go. Is that your book rising up and down? What are we doing? Never mind. I don't want to know. And then you'll also see the covers of his other books. You can click on them right now. You can get them electronically, or you can have them delivered to you in a day or two. Some say that Amazon might deliver by drone in 30 minutes or less. I think they're confused with Domino's. Mike, website?
People can call me up, too. They can go to my website, MikeEdison.com, I should say, and they can contact me, and I'll deliver the book myself. I swear to God, I would do anything to sell a book. I mean, you know, I talk about going on tour, you know, dragging my piano player around. I mean, I'll do the farm report. I'll come to your book club. You know, I'll come to your library. I'll come to your kid's bar mitzvah. I mean, whatever it takes. You know.
Oh, I hope lots of people take you up on those offers. So I know you're on Facebook. Are you a Twitter guy as well these days?
I am. It's Mr. Mike Edison, at Mr. Mike Edison. MikeEdison.com is my website. All the tour dates are up right now. We're doing like 15 events in May. It's good. It's substantial. And, yeah, we're going to be rocking and rolling. And some of those nights are – we got a couple bar events. We're going to do the You Are a Complete Disappointment part of the show. And then we're going to dial it back and do some greatest hits from I Have Fun Everywhere I Go and Dirty, 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 and do some really X-rated blues and really the adult set. So, yeah, awesome. Books and bars, it's also a good combination.
All right. Mike Edison, third-time guest. Thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of boys and girls who can look forward to a lifetime of dumbass shit their parents are genetically bound to say to them in the years ahead, in the Nooney Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Have you ever faced an impossible choice? Like having to choose between medicine or food for your family? Or which one of your children to give the only life vest to?
Millions of people are faced with impossible choices like these every day.
We're in the midst of one of the greatest humanitarian crises of our lifetime. Every day we receive more news, more footage, more facts, and it's hard to know what to do.
But there is an answer. This May, the first ever World Humanitarian Summit is happening.
Our global leaders will be asked to make commitments to end the crisis.
To put humanity first.
Let us commit to end hunger for those in need.
To empower youth impacted by conflict.
To ensure displaced children still receive an education.
To resolve conflict through dialogue and reconciliation rather than violence and revenge.
To eliminate the threat of mines and explosive hazards.
And to make sure no parent
or child has to make an impossible choice.
If we want this to happen,
if we want to actually make things better,
then the choice is clear.
Choice is clear.
We must urge our global leaders
to show up
and take bold action.
Millions are counting on us.
Go to impossiblechoices.org.
Impossiblechoices.org.
To tell your leaders to be there.
To be there.
And put humanity first.